ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi there, book people. Jonathan Green here to let you know about a decidedly bookish episode of RN's food and culture show, Every Bite. You might want to check ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts for our episode titled A Memory of Madeleines. Yes, we take a leaf from Marcel Proust and wonder about food and memory, or more particularly about Madeleines and memory and Marcel Proust. Fun fact, the early drafts of In Search of Lost Time contained no Madeleines. I'll tell you the story of that on Every Bite.
Hello from Whadjuk Noongar land, I'm Claire Nichols, and this is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction writers. Later, Robert Forster is going to join me. You might know him as the singer-songwriter from the iconic Australian band The Go-Betweens. He's written a novel about musos on the run. But first up, it's Maggie O'Farrell and Land. Maggie O'Farrell is here. She is best known for her novels Hamnet, The Marriage Portrait, and her memoir, I Am, I Am, I Am. Her new book, well, the hint is in the title. It is called Land, and it's about an Irish mapmaker and his son and what it means to record and live on the land. Maggie O'Farrell, it's great to have you back on The Book Show.
Thank you very much for having me. It's lovely to be here.
And you had a family member who drew some of the early maps of Ireland. Maggie, tell me about this man.
So we always had a myth in our family. We were told as children that one of our forebears had drawn or worked on the early maps of Ireland. And when I was a child, I think I imagined him as a kind of one-man band. I would look out the window of our car at Dingle or Connemara or Donegal, wherever we happened to be, and I'd think, how would one person go about doing that? But obviously, when I was a bit older, I realised that he was very far from alone. And when I went to search for him in the archives in Dublin, I realised that, of course, the mapping of Ireland, the Ordnance Survey mapping of Ireland, was an enormous project that employed all kinds of people. So it originally started in the 1820s, but my great-great-grandfather worked on the second revisions of the map of Ireland in the late 1840s, 1850s.
Were you able to find evidence of your great-great-grandfather when you went and did that research?
Yes, he was hard to find because if you were Irish and you were employed by the British Ordnance Survey, you were not allowed to sign your own work. It had to be signed by a British Army officer. So I could see his name in lists of labourers, as they were called, on memorandum and payslips and things like that. But the actual field books and notebooks and draft maps, it was really hard to tell what was his. And there were some that I would thought it was maybe his handwriting, but I wasn't entirely sure because if you were Irish, you weren't allowed to sign his own work. So he was definitely there, but it was hard to identify exactly which field notebooks were his.
What inspired this research? Was it because you knew you might want to write a novel about this man?
I've always been really interested in him and his son, my great-grandfather, who, as in the novel, the son has a really interesting trajectory. He goes off and becomes a Jesuit, which anyone who knows anything about the Catholic Church, you know, being a Jesuit is not something you just happen to fall into one day. It's something that you completely dedicate years of your life to train for. So he became a Jesuit and then he left, which in Ireland was an enormous deal. You know, to leave the church in Ireland is, you're risking kind of being a social outcast, really. So he left and he came full circle and became a mapper, just like his father. So that relationship between the two of them has always really fascinated me. And also, when I went to the archives in Dublin, I realised that my great-great-grandfather had been working on the Ordnance Survey revision of Ireland just in the later years of the Great Famine. So it was obvious why they needed to make these revisions, because the famine had completely reconfigured the country. You know, a million people had died, and more than that had been forced to emigrate. And so that's why they needed to revise the maps. And I was just imagining, what must it have been like to be taking on that task, to be making revisions of the map of Ireland, taking into account the disaster that had happened So that, I think, you know, for me, a lot of novels start with a question. And that was, for me, what on earth must that task have been like to undertake?
And I mean, this story, I mean, these two incredible stories have been in your family for so long. Maggie, why do you think now was the time to tell it?
I don't know. It's really hard. You know, I've been thinking about them both for a long time and researching when I could, but there isn't an awful lot that you can find really about either of them. And I think that's the way, if you like to write fiction, that's the way your brain can work. You see those gaps in the record as an opportunity to fill in the story with whatever it is you wanted to say.
It's probably a gift for the novelist, right, to not have too much information, because you go, well, we don't have to stick to the record. I get to get creative.
Well, I think it's, I really enjoyed imagining these people, you know, my forebears, and also, I don't know, sort of filling in the gaps in a way. And I did really try, particularly, of course, writing about the Great Famine. I had a huge amount of vertigo about that because it's such an enormous subject and an enormous task. And it's so important to take something as difficult and tragic as that and to do it justice, you know, to write about it properly. And so I really tried. A lot of the stories that are in the novel are based on real accounts, first-person accounts. So it was very important to me to get it as right as I possibly could, as accurate as I possibly could.
I've never thought a lot about mapping, Maggie, until I read this book. What can you tell me about the relationship between drawing a map and power?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, mapping, I became completely obsessed with mapping as I was writing this novel. And I realised that mapping, in a sense, is a really, really strong human instinct. It actually predates our ability to write. So we were mapping before we were writing. The earliest ever map is on the wall of a cave. It's an Iron Age map on the wall of a cave in what's now the Italian Alps in a place called Bedolina. And somebody at that time was inspired to etch into the rock a really meticulous map of the houses and fields and huts. And, you know, it's this really strong sense of this is who I am, this is where I am, this is my home. But then you fast forward 1,000 years or so and you get to the Roman Empire. And of course, from that point on, it's impossible to disentangle mapping from colonialism, from a statement of power. You know, the Romans arrived in a country, they colonized it, they subjugated the people, they built their roads, they built their towns, and then they drew a map to say, this is ours now, belongs to us.
And I guess it's the same case for Ireland, right? It's the British forces who are in charge of these maps. They're in charge of what things are named. It's about taking away the language as well, right?
The British began mapping Ireland in the 1820s, and it was for taxation purposes, for a tax called the cess tax. And even now in Ireland, there is a phrase where if you want to, it's a very polite way of saying something not very polite, and you say bad cess to you. And that goes right back to that taxation, the name of the taxation. So it was. And initially, the British decided they were not going to employ any Irish people at all on the maps, which caused all endless problems because, of course, you know, the language was a huge barrier and they couldn't ask people, who does this field belong to? Where does the parish boundary end? You know, that was just impossible. And of course, all the place names, you see, are very complicated because it's a place that has had wave after wave of colonizers and people staking ownership. And there were communities on one side of a mountain which had one name for the mountain and a community on the other which had a totally different name for the mountain. So they realised not very far into the project that they had to employ some Irish people on it. And so men like my great-great-grandfather, later, and he was working on the second revision, they were the ones who, you know, they would arrive in a township or a barony and they'd have to set up a sort of headquarters and interview the locals about fields and boundaries and names. And it was people like my great-great-grandfather who had to act as a translator or to, you know, and I realised that actually mapping is such a complicated discipline. It involves mathematics, it involves algebra, it involves art, cartography, history, linguistics, folklore. You know, it's an incredibly complicated. You had to be a Renaissance man to be working on it in those times.
I love seeing the way your face lights up when you're talking about maps, Maggie. And I just think this is so amazing because 5 years ago you and I were talking about Shakespeare and Hamlet, and now, you know, you've found this whole new area of interest. I mean, what a life you lead.
My kids, my teenagers now, they call me a neek. I don't know if you know that name, Claire. It's a cross between a nerd and a geek.
Look, You're with fellow Neeks here on the Book Show, so you're in safe hands.
Good. I'm proud of it. I'm going to wear it as a badge of honour.
So your novel is Land. It opens in 1865 on a peninsula stretching into the Atlantic Ocean. We have the father, Thomas, and the son, Liam. They're out. They're mapping the landscape. And then this dad character, he encounters a spring or a tow bar. Is that how you pronounce it, a tow bar?
Tubber. Yeah.
What happens when he comes across this well of water?
Well, the first line of the novel is, his father was ever a man of few words. And that describes Thomas, who, as we've, you know, made an allusion to, he's been through a very, very, he's had a very, very difficult life. And there are many things that he's seen that he cannot speak about. So one of his solutions, I think, to cope with this is not really to speak very much at all. And he goes into an ancient piece of woodland, a copse, which doesn't appear on the map, and he thinks he's going to have to survey it and map it and put it on the map. But when he's in there, he realises that maybe he shouldn't, because this is a part of Ireland that has never been touched by the colonisers. And he encounters in there a sacred well or a spring or a tubber, as it's called in Irish, and something happens to crack him open. I've always been really fascinated by sacred wells or holy wells, as they're called in Ireland. They're everywhere in the Irish landscape. This is quite unusual to find a town or a village that doesn't have one, at least either in the village or on the outskirts. And they're really fascinating. You know, they go right back to Ireland's pre-Christian, pagan, druidical belief system. And they are seen, I mean, you know, in those days they were worshipped for the hydromancy, and then they became co-opted, quite a few of them, by Christianity and Catholicism, and they were renamed holy wells and given a saint's name. But even now, to this day, people will enact devotions, as they're called, and you walk around them seven times and you can ask for a cure. And, you know, I just find it so fascinating. It's such an incredible fusion of ancient pagan belief and Catholic belief. It's just but also, you know, someone very recently did analysis of the water in some of them, and there's one that's very famous for, said to cure madness, and they discovered that it had very high levels of lithium. So wow. It just goes to show that in all myth there is a seed of truth.
Have you done any of these rituals? Have you done something special at one of these wells?
Oh yeah, I love going to sacred wells or holy wells, and what I really like is finding the ones that are almost sort of just on the verge of being forgotten about, the ones that are overgrown and neglected. I went on a kind of quest for holy wells about two or three years ago in Ireland with my son, who was about 20 at the time, who was really underwhelmed by the whole.
He was calling you a neek again.
Yeah, exactly. But I went with some secateurs because I knew we were going to have to traipse through fields and ask directions. And then when we found these wells, we were going to have to clip all the brambles and nettles away from them. So we did that several times. And it was such a thrill to locate them and to uncover them and see them again.
Okay, so Thomas has this experience with this well. And he comes out of the copse declaring that he is going to change the way he maps the landscape. What is the way he now wants to map, and why is it so subversive?
Well, because he is employed by the Ordnance Survey, which is a British organisation, and it's run by the British Army. And while he's in the copse and he drinks from the tubber, he suddenly sees himself as somebody who's working for the enemy. He sees himself in a different way, and he thinks that he wants to restore Ireland to the way it used to be before it was colonised, and he wants to draw a map of Ireland then, the island that still exists sort of underneath the veneer of colonialism. So that's what he decides to do, which has an interesting knock-on effect on the rest of his family.
I think this book is going to speak so much to readers here in Australia, Maggie, where, you know, we're undergoing our own project of reaching back to Indigenous names for places here in Australia, and we really are looking at our maps in a new way. So it's fantastic that this novel speaks across continents like that.
That's nice. I hadn't imagined it like that, but that makes me very happy that it has a... yes, and I think that's a really interesting project. I mean, it's happening all over the world, isn't it?
Mm.
They're reaching back to names as they were. And I think toponymy, which is the study of place names and why they're called what they are, is so fascinating, because you can always see you can often find something in there. You can see some kind of explanation as to why it's called that and its history. You know, names are not casual. They're always very important and very significant. So that's exciting. I look forward to hearing more about that.
Something really surprising happens in part two of Land, Maggie. We go back thousands of years to meet a girl called Brith. Can you just explain, Maggie, the structure of Land?
That's a big question. So it starts, like you said, in 1865 with a father and son mapping team on a peninsula in the west of Ireland. And it's there that Tomás has an unusual encounter in a copse. And then, so partly the book on one level is a story about a family who are trying to emerge from the long shadow of the Great Hunger. But also I decided, perhaps foolishly, Claire, to tell the whole story of Ireland via this one peninsula, going right back to the very first people that ever lived upon it. So it does, I hope this isn't going to put people off, but it goes right back to the Bronze Age Ireland, to the second wave of people who ever lived there, and a girl called Brith, who lives in a hill fort very near where Tomás and Liam will, millennia later, be mapping the mountains. It was just something that I really, really wanted to do, to examine the whole, you know, the sort of permanence of land versus the impermanence of human life, and how we are really just a blink in the eye of the vast timescape of a landscape.
No, I really liked this section. You do move through history very quickly in this section, and it reminded me of the part in Hamlet where we trace the journey of the plague across the ocean to the UK. You know, it's this very exciting piece of writing where a lot of time happens in quite a small number of pages. It must be a really thrilling writing challenge for you.
It was. I did really enjoy it, and I was looking forward to it, and I knew that I was coming up to that part in the book, but I was anxious because I kept imagining my editor's face. Now, I've had the same editor for 27 years, 26 years, so we know each other very well, and I was just worried when I handed it in to her, I was worried I would get the manuscript back and just in the margin would be basically a WTF. can I say that on air? It sounds really wrong, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Luckily, no, she didn't say that. She liked it. But I did think, I was worried that she would just send it back to me saying, what on earth are you thinking? And to say, Claire, in a very neekish way, there is one clause in the novel that takes you right back to the Ice Age in Ireland. I was so happy that I managed to get it in, because I thought it's only one tiny clause in one sentence, but it does go right back to the glaciers when they were covering Ireland at one point.
For the most part of the novel, we are with this one family in the late 1800s. So we've talked about the mapmaker, Tomás, his son, Liam. We also have Tomás's beloved wife, Fina. We've got the daughters, Enda and Rose. We've got son, Eugene. And there are so many big dramatic moments in this book, Maggie O'Farrell. You know, we've got two children connecting in a workhouse. We have an exorcism. We have a dog that seems to know all. There is so much that happens in Land. It's very sweeping. It's very romantic. Do you consider this your epic?
Oh, that sounds very arrogant if I said yes, I do. I don't know. All I know is that I had an unusual experience with this book, in that as soon as I had the first sentence, I mean, I suppose I'd been thinking about it for a long time, about these two ancestors of mine, and I couldn't really see a way into it as a novel. I couldn't work out where to start in the story and my road into it, in a sense. And then I was on a train going from Belfast to Dublin, and it was delayed, and I was looking out at Ireland. And somehow, I don't know why, the first sentence just came into my head. His father was ever a man of few words. And as soon as I had that sentence, it was like a key turning in a lock, and I could see the novel unrolling before me. And I knew my way along that road. It was really strange. And that is, you know, I think all novels that you write are different, and the ideas come very differently, and they have a very different gestation. And this one, certainly. I mean, I very rarely have the beginning of a book. I usually come around, I usually find that halfway through or so. So this one was very different in that way. So it just kind of unrolled, and I just knew these things had to happen. I knew that there was going to be some emigration. There were going to be a few boats. There was going to be a dramatic incident on a boat. There was, you know, I had it all there. It was all ready.
That's wonderful. Maggie, we've referenced Hamnet a couple of times. I think since we spoke last, you've been to the Oscars because your screen adaptation for Hamnet was nominated for an Oscar, which is absolutely incredible. You looked beautiful in this beautiful pink dress and a veil. Please, please tell me what it's like to go to the Oscars.
It's very surreal, Claire, and very strange. And it takes a while for, well, it took my civilian brain quite a while to kind of catch up with it. And I think what you don't realise when you watch it on TV, it's incredibly long. I mean, we started getting ready at sort of 9 a.m, you know, and you get into your formal evening wear and you have your hair done, or I did. And yeah, I put on my veil and it's, you know, and by the time we were ready, it was sort of 11 a.m. and, you know, it's so bizarre. And then you get in a kind of limousine and you're in a massive queue through security, and there are sniffer dogs checking the car, and your ID gets checked, and the whole thing takes hours. And then you finally arrive at kind of 1 p.m., and then you walk through the photographers, and then, you know, the ceremony doesn't start until 4.
Oh my gosh.
I was so hungry by the end. It was 9:30 by the time it ends, and honestly, I was ready to eat the seats.
That's why you always see the pictures of the after party and everyone stuffing their faces with burgers, right? Because they're ravenous.
You've been literally, you haven't had any food for hours. You know, the weird thing, the weirdest, I suppose the only way to explain the weirdness of it is, you know, you're sitting in this room and you look around and literally everybody you see is somebody you've seen on screen, on TV or cinema in the last 10 years or whatever, or even longer in some cases. There's one point where I was queuing to get out of the aisle, and I heard some people behind me having a conversation, and I thought, that's really strange. That man sounds exactly like George Clooney. And then I thought, oh, that's because it is George Clooney. And that just, it just, you know, your brain is sort of lagging behind the reality of what's going on. But it's, I mean, seeing all the frocks up close, Claire, was the best thing. That was so amazing.
And I reckon, you know, also seeing Jessie Buckley win an Oscar for playing Agnes in Hamnet, this character that came from you, Maggie, what is that like?
Oh, my God. I was just elated when that happened. And we were, all of us, you know, the whole, all the kind of Hamnet people, we were all sitting in a group and we were all on the edge of our seats because we, you know, she was so brilliant in that role. I mean, she is Agnes and Agnes is her, and she poured herself heart and soul every single day, every single take into it. And I mean, quite apart from the fact she is one of the loveliest people you will ever meet. And I know you don't get Oscars for being lovely, but she's so talented, but also so lovely. So it was just one of the best moments of my life seeing her win that award and get that recognition and go up on stage and be given it. It was so thrilling.
There's got to be a little bit of a pat on the back for yourself too, right?
Well, I think, you know, I wrote the book and but I think this film was such a family effort. You know, it was such a collaboration, and Jessie deserves that Oscar, and it's her name on the Oscar, and it's absolutely right. You know, she took Chloe and I took the novel and we made the script, and then Jessie took the script and made that role herself. So she completely deserves all the accolades she's got for it.
Do you want to do more screenwriting? I can imagine a film of Land.
Well, Land has been bought by the same producers as Hamnet.
Wow.
So Liza Marshall, a producer in London who bought Hamnet in manuscript, has bought Land. So it's wonderful because I know that this book, which is very close to my heart, is in best hands possible.
And of course, listeners, you want to be cool and read the book first. It's called Land. It's published by Tinder Press. Maggie O'Farrell, it's always so wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Claire. It's lovely to see you again.
You're listening to The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Claire Nichols. And now let's talk about a new Australian novel that started its life as a song. Songwriters on the Run is the debut novel by Robert Forster, who you might know as the lead singer of the indie band The Go-Betweens. The book is about a couple of jailbreaking musos evading the law. And before it was a book, It was this song from Forster's solo album, Songs to Play.
They both broke out of jail and walked quickly to the nearest hill, where they looked back upon the scale of what they'd done to get to the hill. And they had their songs packed away, no time to waste or lose. And they had their songs to play.
Hi, Robert.
Hello, Claire.
It's a beautiful song. When did you write this song?
I wrote it in 2009 in Germany. My wife is German and our two children were born there. We were living in Brisbane and we used to go over there for Christmases. And I wrote it there right at the end of 2009.
What was on your mind? What inspired the song?
Well, I wrote the melody, which normally happens fairly quickly. And I wrote the tune and I was thinking about, you know, it just the pace of it and the space in the melody suggested a story song to me. There was room there to tell something. What inspired it was there was two in the press in Germany just in that week. There was this big story heated up by the tabloid press about two murderers that had broken out of a jail in Hamburg. And I'm someone that writes song titles in books when I in my journal, when ideas come to me, so I can go back to them exactly like this, where I write a tune and I go, okay, if there's nothing, you know, immediately on my mind, I can go back and I can get some ideas. And I wrote down Criminals on the Run, you know, just because of these two escapees. And then I wrote the tune and then I thought, looked at my book, Criminals on the Run. What do I know about criminals? Nothing. And I just thought, what do I know about songwriters? That's what I do. So I got Songwriters on the Run. It just sort of glued together really quickly. Then for the next 6 years, I thought about these: why they were in jail, why were they breaking out of jail, and where were they going to? It became a sort of a mind puzzle. And so that was like the germ of the book.
Is it usual for a song to stay with you for that long, Robert, to have more questions about a song you've written?
No. This was only the second time that ever happened in my life. And probably by this time I'd written probably close to 200 songs. And I think it's that case with most songwriters. You know, does Paul McCartney ever go back to Eleanor Rigby? Mm. You know, probably not. And you can think, normally songwriters write a song, they finish the two main elements, the melody and the lyric, and then they go on. And that can take, you know, 2 hours, 2 weeks, 2 months, and you're always going on to the next song. You don't sort of look back, you're satisfied with it. And, you know, you might have an album you've got to write, you're writing for a tour or something. And so normally songs always get left behind, and that's completely normal. But there was one song in 1990 and this one that, and both of them are story songs. You know, like you write three verses and then you're going, but, you know, like this could be, you know, like 3,000 words, you know, like this. There, you know, like you just write a snippet and then it doesn't leave your brain, and that's what happened to me.
You mentioned your wife. Is that your wife's voice we're hearing singing along with you on that track?
Yeah, it's a duet that we didn't record the song till 2015 for the Songs to Play album. And Karen, she also plays violin, and so her and I sing and sing songs together on all of my albums, really, just one or two every now and then. But, music is something that brought us together, and it's something that we sort of really enjoy at home.
I love hearing the evolution of this. So you come up with the song in 2009, takes another 6 years for you and your wife to record it together. Mm. The question still stays with you. What happened to these blokes? Why were they in jail?
Yeah.
And the answer is a novel, Robert Forster. Yeah. Had you ever had aspirations to write fiction before?
There's some, you have to call it scribbling, in the 90s in this journal that I was talking about. I sort of, normally I fill a journal about once a year, 1.5 years, normally blank pages, you know, those sort of nice sort of leather bound things if I can find them in various bookshops. So when I look back at in the 90s, I was writing some fiction. Normally I'd write for about 2 days and I it just wasn't going anywhere. I had no skills, like none. And so I was also by that time in my mid to late 30s. There was a need to do it, but there wasn't the skills to take it anywhere, basically. And I was sort of living in Germany. I had no contact to the publishing world. I didn't know any writers. I was still writing songs. And I just thought, well, that's just something that I'm doing every now and then. And really, I just left it at that. That's the only sort of attempt at a novel I've ever done.
Mm, and what made you think now is the time? Maybe I can actually write a novel.
Well, in 2005, I was hired as the music critic for the Monthly, and I was 47 years old. And this was really the start of my writing career outside of songs. And so I wrote for the Monthly for 8 years, and I was working with editors. I was writing 1,500, 2,000 words a month. I was basically doing my apprenticeship right there on the page. And then a couple of years into the Monthly, I got approached by a publisher to what if I wanted to write anything. And then I started on another long piece of nonfiction called Grant and I, which was a memoir. Mm. And so at times for a couple of years there, I was writing for the Monthly and writing Grant and I at the same time. And it was all nonfiction. It was wonderful. I was learning so much. I was gaining all those skills I didn't have in the 90s. And then Grant and I came out in 2016. I'd stopped with the Monthly in 2013. And I just wanted to write free. I just wanted to make it up. I was, you could say I was tired of being fact-checked. Yeah. You know, I was just ready to just blast and just write. You know, he woke up in the morning and he walked out and there was a strange person in the kitchen and then he made his Weet-Bix and then the phone rang, all of that sort of stuff, you know.
You keep talking about the fact that you didn't have the skills, Robert, but of course you're an acclaimed songwriter. You do have a way with words, with the lyrics you've written. Did those skills not help you with the transition to longer form writing?
They did. They're a form of, although they're not, they don't correspond to poetry, but they are, you are using words, you are trying to be as sort of, make your writing as attractive and entertaining and accessible as possible. Also, I'm a reader and I've always been a reader. So those two things go together, but they don't make you a novelist or a writer, really. I mean, look, there's probably people that could write off the bat, you know, like they could just do it. But I was someone that needed that time doing journalism and doing, and this is a common path, I'd imagine, to novelists. They start off in journalism. But it's something that just I needed to be able to do paragraph after paragraph and know something about punctuation and building something.
Okay, and the result is Songwriters on the Run, your first novel. Who are our songwriters on the run?
They're two guys in their early 30s. One's called Mick Woods and the other's called Drew Lovelock. Basically, they come from two different backgrounds. Drew has been who comes from Brisbane, was basically had a band in Brisbane for 2 years. And then in the 80s, he was in a band called The Shells, who was sort of an underground pop, psychedelic pop band. Like not unlike someone like The Church, you know, like sort of good-looking boys playing. And they made a couple of albums, but they never broke through the way, say, The Church did. While Mick Woods was more a Sydney goth, you know, like post-punk guy in a number of bands. And they knew each other through the underground scene. So they'd sort of been in contact with each other, you know, touring and running into each other at pubs or parties. And then in 1987, with The Shells gone and Drew looking for a new musical direction, more acoustic singer-songwriter, he ran into Mick at a party in Surrey Hills, and Mick's goth career was over, and he was sick of being in bands and just making noise, and he was actually starting to write sort of more confessional songs on acoustic guitar, and they meet, and they realise, although they're very different backgrounds and different characters, that they could do something together. and they wanted to, and it was just this magic moment, and that's the start of the band.
How much are you drawing on your own music life here, Robert? How much are you drawing upon musicians that you know? How much of that experience of the music scene has found its way into this novel?
That's about 60%. Mm-hmm. I actually have a formula that I don't really stick to. You're exactly right. It's stuff that is my life that I've lived and seen. Then there's stuff that is not me that I've seen and experienced. And then there's about 30% is sort of unknown, is sort of stuff that I make up. And that's sort of a mix that I try and do. And what I try and do is sort of weave it in a way that I do with my songwriting as well. You know, like I think relentless, confessional, first-person songwriting can just get too much. Mm-hmm. And you need to bring in things you've seen, or you need to make it up, and you just... You know, like you just get this mix going of observation. And it's the same with the book. I sort of approached it like that as well, where I'd sort of go in of really close stuff to me, and then I'd sort of go out. And so, like, in the book, there's sort of, it even goes to towns, you know, like they'll be in Rockhampton, and then they'll be in Childers. But between Rockhampton and Childers, they're in Flats Crossing and Thamalga, which are made up. Mm-hmm, and so that sort of goes into the whole book as well. That's just the way that I work. So there's real bands and there's fake band names.
Tell us what happens to Mick and Drew. Why are these two singer-songwriters arrested?
There's a number of things. I didn't want it to be like murder or a big bank robbery or something like that, because that'd just sort of nail it all down. I thought they'd be on the road and it'd be a couple of things they get picked up on in a country town. They're driving a stolen car as their tour vehicle. They are using a credit card that is in their names that has now run up to $18,000, which they're not aware of because their manager hadn't explained that part of the deal to them. And the third thing is a fan gives them a bag of marijuana backstage, and the police arrive to arrest the Mick and Drew in Rockhampton on the credit card, and then things suddenly gets bigger. But I thought those sort of things, if they didn't know about the car being stolen and they're given the drugs, that they might just sort of go, we're innocent and we want to get out of jail.
Yeah, and it's no spoiler to say that, because we've heard the first verse of the song. We know they broke out of jail and they're on the run. They get a bit of help on the way, and I liked that the biggest heroes of the story might be the roadies. They're the ones coming to help our songwriters. Yeah. Was this a deliberate choice to celebrate the roadies in this book?
Yeah, I think it's a very, very strong relationship that a band very quickly builds up with their road crew. This is why artists work with the same people year. It can go on for decades. It's a very, very close relationship developed through, you know, like an artistic adventure. And so the roadie, whose name is Swifty, who's in the car when they're in Rockhampton, is sort of just sort of would do anything for the two songwriters, is, you know, like really vital. And he's sort of very good at his job of basically sometimes cleaning up the mess that the songwriters leave behind, but also driving them and carrying the gear and doing all this. And it's something that I've seen and experienced in my own musical career.
So, Robert, you now can add author, published author, to your business card. You're still gigging as well, right?
I am, and I'm still writing songs and I'm recording.
And will we see more novels from you?
Really good question. Look, I hope so. I've sort of started on something new and I've got to get back to it. The thing with Songwriters on the Run is that I was doing two things at the one time. I was writing my first novel, so I was learning how to write a novel while writing a novel, and the book took 9 years. Admittedly, I was like doing albums and touring, but I spent probably a good 4 years, 5 years on the book. And now that I've learned how to write it, I really like to write something more, and I've really enjoyed this process. I love the book, and hopefully it'll come to me quicker.
The book is Songwriters on the Run. It's by Robert Forster, and it's published by Penguin. Robert, so lovely to meet you today.
Wonderful to talk to you, Claire. Thank you very much for inviting me on the show.
This has been The Book Show, produced by Sarah Lestrange. Today you heard from Maggie O'Farrell about her book Land and Robert Forster on Songwriters on the Run. And the conversations with your favourite fiction authors, well, they keep on coming. Next time, Susan Choi will be here to talk about her fabulous novel Flashlight. Until then, I'm Claire Nichols, and make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.